From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning we talk with Jamie Farrell. He's a chief seismologist of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory and research assistant professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. We talk about the recent explosion in Yellowstone National Park. Then we talk with Anil Seth. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah and co-principal investigator of the discovery of the most solid evidence ever for an intermediate mass black hole. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Just 400 miles to the north of us lies Yellowstone National Park, a place of unparalleled natural beauty, wildlife, and thermal activity. And most of us tend to forget that Yellowstone also happens to be a volcanic system that has had massive eruptions over the past 2.1 million years. Well, on July 23rd, an explosion in Biscuit Basin reminded us of Yellowstone's hydrothermal nature and its power. Here to talk with us about the explosion and Yellowstone's volcanic past is Jamie Farrell, chief seismologist of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory and research assistant professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. Jamie, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
All right, before we talk about Biscuit Basin, remind our listeners, and Lynn and myself, of the volcanic system that Yellowstone is.
Yeah, so Yellowstone, like you said, is an active volcano. It's not, you know, your typical volcano that people tend to think about where you have this big mountain and you can clearly see where the volcano is at. It's called a caldera, and it's very large. It's one of the largest volcanoes on Earth. And over the last 2.1 million years, it's had three really large cataclysmic caldera-forming eruptions and numerous smaller eruptions that produced large lava flows on the surface. Today, if you go to Yellowstone, if you're in the interior part of Yellowstone, you are within the caldera of the last major eruption, which was about 631,000 years ago. But, you know, some of the evidence that you have in Yellowstone that this is an active volcanic center is of course the massive hydrothermal system that we have in Yellowstone that feeds all the wonderful geysers and hot springs that people come to visit. You know, Yellowstone is home to over half of the world's geysers. And then, you know, if you look closely, you can see most of the rocks in Yellowstone are volcanic in nature. They're mostly lava flows from these large rhyolite lava flows that came out, the youngest one, which is about 70,000 years ago. We haven't had an eruption since then, but we have other hazards related to the volcanic system. We have earthquakes. Yellowstone's one of the most seismically active areas in the interior west, in the Intermountain West. It averages about 1,500 to 2,500 earthquakes per year. Yeah, and that's what makes it such a spectacular place.
I've been reading about some of the past eruptions in Yellowstone, and one of them, and I don't know if it was the original one at 2.1 million years ago or the one you just talked about from 640,000 years ago, but the amount of material that was ejected was over 2,000 times what we saw from Mount St. Helens. Which eruption was that, and are those numbers correct?
Yeah, so that's the 2.1 million year old eruption, the first one. And it was 2,500 times larger than Mount St. Helens. That's how much material it put out.
So aside from this hydrothermal activity, is there the threat of another massive eruption from Yellowstone?
I mean, it probably will erupt again, but not in our lifetime. It's you know, these are large hazardous events, but they don't happen very often. And, you know, that's why we monitor the volcanic system, because when you have a volcanic eruption, when magma is moving closer and closer to the Earth's surface, it tends to put off signals that we can record. We would record lots of earthquakes, lots of ground deformation, changes in the amount of gas coming out of the ground. And those are the types of things that we monitor for in Yellowstone. So if there was going to be a volcanic eruption, we believe that we would know that it was coming and be able to provide ample warning. And then also, you know, people tend to focus on these really large, huge cataclysmic eruptions. if there was going to be an eruption, the most likely one would be one of these smaller lava flows that's entirely contained within the park. You know, not to say that that wouldn't cause a lot of havoc and a lot of damage and hazards, but these really big volcanic eruptions don't happen very often. And at this point, you know, from what we know about the magmatic system beneath Yellowstone, it doesn't look like it's anywhere near one of these eruptions.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Jamie Farrell. He's the chief seismologist of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory and assistant professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. Jamie, I think there are some important distinctions from what I've read about volcanic activity and hydrothermal activity. And the recent explosion at Biscuit Basin was not volcanic, it was hydrothermal. What's the difference?
So the big difference is that there is no magma involved in the explosion we had at Biscuit Basin last week. Now, not to say that the activity that we saw in Biscuit Basin wasn't related to the volcanic system, right? The hydrothermal system is there because of the volcanic system, but there was no magma involved in the explosion at Biscuit Basin. And all you know, these hydrothermal explosions, which they're called, happen because you have this hydrothermal system, right? You have hot thermal water coming up, and that thermal water is right near the boiling point. You know, it's pretty close to the boiling point. And also it has a lot of minerals dissolved in it. And as it cools and it reaches the surface, it tends to deposit a lot of those minerals. And sometimes they deposit too much and it starts to clog up their plumbing system, right? And they get blocked up. And then, you know, just any kind of blockage like that changes the pressure regime underneath the ground. And that water is so close to boiling, that change in pressure can cause it to instantly flash to steam. And then when water, flashes the steam, it expands a ton. And that's why you get these huge explosions from that water flashing the steam and exploding out of the ground and taking rock and mud and debris with it. So that's the difference, is that this was all only involved water and no magmatic material.
Okay, so then the predictability of these events don't really differ between whether they're volcanic or hydrothermal. Is that correct?
No, I would say they do differ in that.
Okay.
You know, like I said before, it's really hard for magma to move in the ground and shallow without breaking rock, causing deformation and all that kind of stuff. And we record those signals. But these hydrothermal explosions, as far as we can tell right now, don't put out a lot of precursory activity. Now, there's a caveat to that, in that, you know, when we put in monitoring systems in Yellowstone, we designed our monitoring system to monitor the system as a whole, the whole volcanic system, to look for, you know, things related to the volcanic system. We tend to avoid putting stations within the hydrothermal basins because they're noisy. All that boiling water and stuff makes a lot of noise that we record on our seismometers. So, you know, when we say we haven't recorded any precursory signals, that may be because we just don't have stations close enough to record these really small signals related to these hydrothermal explosions. And in fact, over the last few years, we've actually been thinking about this, and we've been kind of designing what we call a hydrothermal monitoring system. And last year, we installed our first station to start one of these hydrothermal monitoring systems, but that was in Norris Geyser Basin. We chose Norris Geyser Basin because it has a lot of history of a lot of these explosions. And we actually recorded our first hydrothermal explosion in Norris earlier this year. We were out walking around in May looking for a place for another station. And we came across this little crater that was probably about maybe 6 feet across, something like that. And we knew that wasn't there last time we were there. So we knew it had happened between, you know, last time we were there and the time that we were there presently. And we looked back at some of aerial photography or some satellite imagery, and we kind of narrowed it down to when these changes occurred between, you know, X day and X day. And we went back and looked at the signals from this new station, and there it was. We found this signal from this hydrothermal explosion, and we knew it happened on April 15th, 2024. And this was a really small one. This was nowhere near what happened in Biscuit Basin last week. And it's not even, it's farther away from the boardwalk. And in fact, the park was closed to visitors at that point. So, but we recorded one and we looked at the data and we didn't see any precursory signals to that one either. But that one was really small. We're moving ahead. We're kind of keep building out this hydrothermal monitoring system. And then if we get it worked out and we can record these signals, and then we can start moving into other places in the park like Biscuit Basin or Upper Geyser Basin. But it's definitely a hazard and a risk that we are aware of, and that is probably underappreciated in Yellowstone.
Well, as I was doing a lot of the research, Jamie, so much of the information I found referred to Yellowstone's quote unquote plumbing system that I'm assuming helps move the water around. Tell us about the plumbing system, and is that unique to the Yellowstone area?
Anywhere you have hydrothermal activity, you have to have some kind of conduit to move that water from at depth to the surface. When you talk about Yellowstone's plumbing system, there's kind of two different scales, right? There's the magmatic plumbing system that's moving hot material, magma and heat from deep within the earth up to the upper crust. And then there's the hydrothermal plumbing system, which, you know, is for hydrothermal water is being circulated throughout the crust and coming up to the surface. Now, we know quite a bit about the magmatic plumbing system through seismic imaging of the crust and the mantle. We know less about the hydrothermal plumbing system. We have been doing work the last few years, putting in seismic stations around features in Yellowstone, like Old Faithful and Steamboat Geyser. And we've learned about that plumbing system. We've been able to image that down to about 300 feet beneath the surface. And it's quite interesting is that, you know, some of them go straight down beneath the feature. Some of them take turns and come down at an angle. So it's not the same for every feature. And it's quite different on how different features nearby each other kind of interact with each other, how connected they are. Some features are close by and seem to have no connection with other features. Some other features are clearly connected to other features nearby. For example, Steamboat Geyser, the largest active geyser in the world, in Norris Geyser Basin. There's a pool about 100 yards away called Cistern Pool, Cistern Spring. And every time Steamboat has a major eruption, Cistern completely drains and then slowly fills back up. So those two are obviously connected at depth. But a feature like Old Faithful, that's kind of out by itself, not really near other major features, seems to have its own system. And that's probably why it's predictable, because it's not competing for water and heat from other features nearby that it's connected to. You know, Old Faithful is famous because it's predictable, and there are certain other geysers in Yellowstone that are predictable, but that's the exception. Most geysers are not predictable and are somewhat random.
Talking about water, back in 2014, I think it was, when the Firehole Lake area, the roads were melting and buckling. How is that related to this plumbing system?
Well, that's a combination of features. They've always had problems with Firehole Lake Drive, you know, and you're going to have problems anytime you build a road through a hydrothermal basin, because these are dynamic systems. And just because when you built the road, the ground didn't seem to be active when you built it, doesn't mean it's not going to be in the future. And you know, certain features are active for years and then they can die off, and then new features pop up in other places. So, you know, it's not surprising that they have issues with these roads when they build them in hydrothermal basins. It's just the way it is. And in fact, you know, they have to move boardwalks every once in a while in these geyser basins because new features pop up right beneath them or right next to them. And it's not safe for having to have a boardwalk there. So yeah, this is something that they just have to live with.
Jamie, it is kind of crazy when you look at the boardwalk at Biscuit Basin now, mm-hmm. and to think that there were people there. It's wonderful that no one was hurt, especially with, you know, what did they say? Like rocks that were blown up, you know, hundreds of feet, that weighed hundreds of pounds, and no one was hit by any of that debris. So was that because it was well planned, that the boardwalk, you know, the people were only a certain, you know, distance from this area, and or was it just dumb luck that no one was hurt?
I think it was just complete luck and the timing of the event. Luckily, if you know, I was just there, I was putting on instrumentation around, and even more so than when seeing the videos, I was blown away that nobody was hurt, seeing all the debris on the boardwalk, around the boardwalk. It's just insane to me that nobody was hurt, luckily. You know, this explosion happened, you know, just before 10 a.m. On the 23rd. And I think if this would have happened 2 hours later, 3 hours later, it might be a different story. There might have been more people there. But it's definitely, you know, a decision needs to be made. And luckily, it's not my decision. It's the Park Service decision who makes those decisions on what to do with the boardwalk, whether they just rebuild it or they move it. You know, they have moved boardwalks in the past, like I said. But yeah, they're going through those decision trees right now on what they want to do with that boardwalk. They have time because Biscuit Basin is going to be closed for the remainder of the season. So they'll have time to make that decision and hopefully do what's best for their interests as well as the safety of visitors to Biscuit Basin.
So in terms of the predictability of the hydrothermal activity, of course, in Biscuit Basin, this wasn't predicted at all. I'm wondering, you know, even Old Faithful, that's named Old Faithful for its predictability, I was reading that it's no longer as predictable as it used to be. I think it used to be about every 90 minutes, but I read that it can erupt between, you know, 35 minutes and 120 minutes now. What are some of the factors that change the predictability if that is indeed something that's happening in the Yellowstone area?
Old Faithful is still just as predictable as it used to be. It's just that the interval between eruptions has lengthened with time. So back in the, you know, 50s, it was every 60 minutes or so it would erupt. And then as time has gone on up to now, it's about every 90 minutes is when it erupts now, give or take 10 minutes. But, and this has always been the case, it does every once in a while throw in a 60 minute or so interval eruption. And like I said, this is not surprising in that these features are dynamic and there are different things that happen. And in fact, one of the major things that change how geysers, you know, their predictability how they erupt and their dynamics are earthquakes. And one major change that happened to Old Faithful was the 1959 Hebgen Lake earthquake that occurred just outside the park to the west in Montana. There's a magnitude 7.3 earthquake. And there were major changes to the hydrothermal system, to multiple features in Yellowstone, including Old Faithful. Other features that haven't been active in a long time suddenly sprang to life, started geysering. Features that have been acting a certain way changed their activity. So, and this has happened many times, not just local earthquakes. In 2002, there was a magnitude 7.9 earthquake in Alaska. And as that seismic energy came through Yellowstone, not only did we have a bunch of triggered earthquakes from that, all these earthquakes started happening, but we had a lot of changes to the hydrothermal system as well. A lot of features changed their activity as that seismic energy passed through. So there are a lot of things that can change how a certain feature behaves, including, you know, climate. As you get into a wetter season or a drier season, these features change. And in fact, there are, on both Steamboat Geyser and Old Faithful Geyser, there are old dead tree stumps on their cones that have been covered up with all the sinter that's being deposited. And scientists have taken samples of those trees and dated them. And both of them show that they're about, I don't know the exact age, but some are, you know, 10 to 13,000 years ago or somewhere in that ballpark when they were alive. And this corresponds to a very dry period, a drought, extended drought, where we think that both Old Faithful and Steamboat stopped activity. They stopped erupting for a long time, which allowed soils to start growing around there and trees to start growing around these features and both of them. So, you know, climate change, earthquakes, certainly man-made activity can alter hydrothermal systems. There was a proposal a while back to drill for geothermal energy on the outskirts of Yellowstone, and the Park Service fought that quite a bit, because as you drill and suck water and heat away from the system, you could dramatically affect the hydrothermal features in Yellowstone.
Well, Jamie, we all saw 2 summers ago, I think it was, the flooding in Yellowstone from that incredible snow year that the West had. What did you see in terms of geyser activity, especially 2 years ago?
Yeah, we didn't really see any changes from that. And, you know, those types of events are kind of one-off, really quick, really fast. And, you know, when we're talking about changes, we're talking about kind of longer-term, multi-year changes in the amount of water. Now, you know, we've had a few good winters in a row up there. So maybe we'll start seeing different patterns of hydrothermal features, but we haven't really seen anything major yet.
Well, let's circle back to the Yellowstone volcano itself. What is the underlying structure? Is the continent of the U.S. moving across a hot spot?
Yep, exactly. So Yellowstone is a hot spot. And what that means is you have this fixed source of heat coming up from deep within the earth, from the mantle, and it's fixed. It doesn't move. Then you have the North American plate moving to the southwest at about around like an inch a year, kind of that range. It's about the same speed that your fingernails grow. That's how fast the continent is moving to the southwest. So that's moving over the hotspot. So as the crust over the hotspot moves to the southwest, the hotspot kind of migrates to the northeast. And so Yellowstone over the last 17 million years or so has moved from kind of Nevada, Oregon border area up to where it is now. And there's a whole, you know, the Snake River Plain is kind of the track of the Yellowstone hotspot as it's moved up to the northeast. And there's a whole track of explosive centers down the Snake River Plain that are basically old Yellowstones, been there for quite a while. And, you know, the current area where it's at right now is on the north, you know, northwest corner of Wyoming. And it'll continue to move to the northeast. Now, it's starting to get into different rocks that it's trying to burn through that it has before. It's starting to move into what we call craton, which is kind of these thick, cold areas of continents. So it's going to have a harder time kind of making its way through this thick, cold rock that it has in the past. So how will that affect it moving forward? We don't really know, but it might change a little bit.
Jamie, one of the things, and maybe this is kind of a good way to conclude the interview, is talking about, you know, people love the drama and the chaos and the disaster, or they love to talk about it and they love to think about it. And, you know, even, you know, asking about that, when's the super volcano going to happen? And, you know, your response is not in our lifetimes. So do we really think about it? And I'm just curious, I don't even know if you pay attention to conspiracy theories or how you counter them with the work that you do. But, you know, since Biscayne Basin has blown up, I'm just curious about that question. What are the conspiracy theories and why should we disregard them or not even pay attention to them?
Yeah, we get that question all the time. When does this mean the Yellowstone's going to blow? When is it going to blow? When's the world going to end? And, you know, the only way you can really counter that is by putting out as much information as you can, being as transparent as you can. You know, all the data we collect in Yellowstone are all freely available online for people to look at. And, you know, every time we have a big earthquake swarm in Yellowstone, every time something like Biscayne Basin happens, it tends to put, you know, the doomsdayers in hyperdrive. And, you know, all we can do is point to what we know about the system in that, you know, at this point, to the best of our knowledge of all the data that we've collected, the Yellowstone magma reservoir that sits about 4 kilometers beneath, you know, 5 miles beneath your feet when you're in Yellowstone. Right now, the best we can estimate is that it is about 20% molten material. Most of it is just hot, solid rock, and only 20% of it is molten. Now, how that's distributed throughout the whole system, we don't really know exactly. We don't have good enough resolution to know, you know, really fine details of that. But our best estimate is that to have, you know, magma be mobile and be able to move to the surface to have an eruption, you have to have greater than 50% molten material. Right now, it's just too much solid material for that molten material to move around. So that's why we say it's nowhere near an eruption right now. Now, that could change, but that takes a while for a system that large to make those kind of changes. And we monitor for that. We look for that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's really hard to control the misinformation, and we try our best, but all we can do is answer questions truthfully and try to put out as much accurate information as we can. And the fact is that Yellowstone is an active volcanic system. We see lots of earthquakes. We see lots of ground deformation. The ground is constantly going up and down related to the magmatic system and the hydrothermal system. We have hazards related to that volcanic system, big earthquakes, hydrothermal explosions like we had last week. But at this point, it doesn't look like there's any evidence of impending volcanic activity at Yellowstone. And that's all we can say.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Well, our guest today has been University of Utah Geology and Geophysics Research Assistant Professor Jamie Farrell. He is also Chief Seismologist of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Jamie, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally. What can seven fast-moving stars within a globular cluster indicate to astronomers? Well, if you are looking for black holes, quite a bit. In fact, these stars and the evidence they provide of the existence of a black hole are a really big deal. Here to tell us about this once-in-a-career discovery is Anil Seth, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Utah and co-principal investigator of this extraordinary finding. Anil, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thanks, Katie.
So before we get started, remind our listeners really what black holes are. I mean, we have this vision from media and television, but really, truly, what is a black hole?
Yeah, so it's actually pretty simple. Like if you think about, if you want to get off of Earth, you have to move at a certain speed, right? And the denser you make Earth or the more massive you make Earth, the faster you need to move. And eventually that speed that you need to move to, like be in a rocket to blast off Earth, would be actually faster than the speed of light. And at that point, you'd have a black hole and you wouldn't be able to get off of it because nothing can move faster than the speed of light. So conceptually, it's pretty simple. Like, you know, it's just that idea of just like gravity being super strong. But lots of crazy things happen around black holes, and black holes actually play a really important role in galaxies and their formation. So there's a lot of interesting things about them apart from just their kind of extreme mass.
What evidence has been gathered in the past for black holes?
Yeah, there's probably the most famous detection of a black hole is the one at the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. Which astronomers, a couple of different groups of astronomers, have been tracking stars orbiting around that black hole for more than two decades. And they found from their orbits, you can easily just determine how much mass must be within that orbit. They found that it's something like 4 million times the mass of our sun. So it's this very, it's called a supermassive black hole. But it turns out that we know about lots of black holes, especially of the supermassive variety, because when material falls onto them, they light up very brightly as the material kind of spirals down and loses energy and falls into the black hole. That energy is released as light. And in fact, it's one of the most efficient ways to turn mass into energy. And so these black holes at the centers of galaxies can actually, when material falls on them, they can be brighter than the entire galaxy that surrounds them. And so for about 50 years, we've known about these objects called quasars, which are black holes, these same supermassive black holes like we find in our Milky Way, but with lots of material being dumped onto them.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anil Seth. He is talking with us about his new finding around the discovery of elements of black holes. Let's talk about these seven stars.
Yeah, maybe I'll tell you just a little story about how we got this data and how we discovered these stars.
Yeah.
So it turns out that there's this massive star cluster in our Milky Way, the most massive star cluster in a Milky Way. It's called Omega Centauri. It's actually a naked eye object in the southern hemisphere. So you can see it if you go somewhere like Chile or something like that, you can see it with your eye. But that cluster of stars has been used for over a decade as a calibration source for the Hubble Space Telescope. So Hubble every once in a while says, does everything working just fine and all my pixels are all okay? And it takes a picture of that cluster. And it's been doing that regularly. And so that means there's this incredible archive. It's more than 500 images of the center of this cluster that have been taken over a period time period of about 20 years. And these are all really high resolution, beautiful Hubble Space Telescope images. And we can actually measure the positions of each individual star in those images really clearly. And so about 4 years ago, my collaborator Nadine Neumeier at the Max Planck Institute of Astronomy in Germany had a new grad student starting and decided to have this new graduate student work on this project to look for the motions of stars, all 1.5 million stars that we can observe from these images. And it turns out that from those 1.5 million stars and they're tracking their motions across the sky, we found right at the center of the cluster, there was 7 stars that were moving much faster than we would expect. And what we would expect is based on the same idea of escape velocity. If a star is moving fast enough, it'll just leave the cluster. And these stars were all moving faster than that escape velocity of the cluster. And the only way to explain them being held in place there right at the center of the cluster was if there's a very massive object there. And that's why we think these are really, really strong evidence for a black hole at the center of, massive black hole at the center of this cluster.
So how does this change looking for black holes going forward?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One is it's actually the closest massive black hole we know to us. So it's actually closer than the center of our Milky Way. So this object just by itself will be an exciting object to follow up on. There's a lot of possibilities that exist for tracking individual stars around the black hole and material falling onto it that aren't possible at more larger distances. But I think the other thing that's exciting about it is that it's in this new class of black holes masses. So we know about black holes that form from the death of stars. These are like sometimes about 10 times the mass of our sun. And we call those normal or stellar mass black holes. And then there's these supermassive black holes that we found at the centers of galaxies, like the one in our Milky Way. And there had been this huge gap of like 3 orders of magnitude, meaning between about 100 and 100,000, there was no black holes that we knew we had really convincing evidence of. And so this is, I think, the first really strong evidence for a black hole in that mass range. And that's what makes it really exciting, because we don't really understand how these supermassive black holes form. And one of the, you know, they must have formed from some sort of initial seed and grown over time as material falls onto them. But we don't know what those seeds were or how those seeds were formed. And this really provides some important clues to have a black hole this low in mass.
Well, I was reading in the Nature article that one of the things you postulate is that this black hole, this region, was swallowed up by the Milky Way. So does that mean that this black hole is within our galaxy?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a star cluster within our galaxy. And it's a really weird star cluster. It's, as I mentioned, it was the most massive one. But it also has clearly many generations of stars. It's not just a single group of stars. So most star clusters, there's like basically a single population of stars that all formed at the same time. And then they like live their lives together. They're like a little family of stars flying through the galaxy. This Omega Sen cluster clearly formed stars many, many times. And we think that's because it was at the core, at the center of a smaller galaxy that fell into the Milky Way. In fact, that smaller galaxy has a name now because we've identified a bunch of debris from it in our Milky Way, and it's called the Gaia Enceladus galaxy. And so we think it was the core of this Gaia Enceladus galaxy, probably the biggest building block of our galaxy, and it fell into the Milky Way and has been orbiting around. You know, all its outer layers got torn away, but this dense star cluster at the center just kept orbiting around in the Milky Way.
Well, you were saying that you were able to utilize 500 Hubble images over, 20 years, I think it was, that the images were taken.
That's right.
Will you be able to partner with the James Webb Telescope as well to bring in additional data?
Yeah, last fall, I wrote a proposal to try following up. We discovered these stars, Max discovered these stars about last summer, about a year ago. And so last fall, we were like excited about, you know, working on this. And I wrote a James Webb Space Telescope proposal to follow up to get the third dimension of motions. So right now we know their motion on the sky. So we can watch them move across the sky, but we don't know how fast they're moving towards or away from us. We can get that third dimension of the motion by getting very deep James Webb Space Telescope spectra, where you basically split the light up into its different colors, and we can measure Doppler shifts from those stars to measure their motions. And wow. I think that unfortunately the data is not going to come till next summer, but it'll come next summer.
Okay. Well, we'll just schedule an interview now for next summer then. So this discovery was part of the Omega Cat project. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So because this cluster is such an interesting cluster, my collaborator Nadine and I started this project to try really kind of characterizing its history and understanding how it was formed. We, for a long time, both of us have worked on these nuclear star clusters, which are the center star clusters of galaxies. And this turns out like it's the very nearest example of one of those objects. So we started this project, and the overall project included getting Hubble Space Telescope data, new Hubble Space Telescope data, which I led, and then also getting data from the Very Large Telescope in Chile, which is, that data was a spectroscopic data. It allows us to, like I mentioned with the James Webb Space Telescope, get the motions towards and away from us and also characterize the compositions of the stars. And so we have this really comprehensive data set. We have the spectra, the kind of rainbows for 300,000 stars. We know the motions of 1.5 million stars. So it's this really incredible data set that really is telling us a lot about the history of this star cluster.
Well, for all of us that see these images and hear about these great reports and great studies, what we see, especially with, you know, like Hubble images and James Webb images, are these, I don't want to say manipulated, but they put together these images with all the data that come in. And so we have this visual representation of what, you know, the pillars of creation look like, or these globular clusters. But that's not what you see and what you take in. What does the data look like at your end? And how do you extrapolate that to create these new findings?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of the images you see, I wouldn't say they're real images. You know, they're all based on data, but they are processed in a way that's different than what the raw data is. So when we get images from Hubble, we get an image in a single filter. So with basically just one wavelength or one color of light. So a red, just red light, or just blue light, or just green light. And then we stack those images together. We combine them like in Photoshop, basically, in order to create the color images that you see. But for this project, one of the key things was actually taking all the individual images in, say, just one color filter. So say just yellow light. And there's actually about 300 yellow light images of the center of Omega Centauri, and actually measuring very precisely each individual star in that image. So basically measuring how bright it is and exactly what its center is. That allows us to see the motion of the stars across the sky. And the fastest star that we found moves 2 pixels in 20 years. So you can kind of get the sense of like, this is a really hard measurement. You know, you can't just be like eyeballing it. Although actually that one you can eyeball, you can make a video, you can actually see that star moving just a little bit. But you know, 2 pixels is not a lot. Like you can think about it on your digital camera. So yeah, so that motion is really hard to extract. And so that's the kind of processing that was required. And that, you know, requires essentially creating a model for what a star looks like, fitting that to each star in the image. It's very computationally intensive and time intensive. And it took Max 4 years to do all that work.
Wow, I'm sure. Well, how will astronomers utilize your discovery going forward? Does this give them something else to look for, another indicator in the night sky for other black holes?
Yeah. So I think there's certainly going to be an effort to try finding fast stars in other star clusters in our Milky Way. There are other star clusters that we know are the centers of former centers of galaxies. And then there's other ones that we suspect may have been. And then also there might be, you know, if they're in Omega Centauri, maybe they're just in every single star cluster and they're just lower mass because they're lower mass clusters. And so I think there's going to be an effort to try finding fast stars. I'm hoping to, you know, write some proposals to do exactly that. And then I think the other thing is that we can try detecting, I mentioned that, you know, black holes can be really bright when stuff falls onto them. And no place in space is a perfect vacuum. So no matter where something is, it should be a little bit bright as the material, the black hole should shine a little bit, or the material around black hole should shine a little bit as it falls in to the black hole. And we're hoping to be able to, we have approved data on the ALMA telescope, which is a millimeter wave telescope, to follow up on this. And also with the James Webb data, we have a potential of finding the what we call the accretion counterpart, meaning the stuff that's falling onto the black hole. And so I think that looking for those kind of accretion signatures, the activity from the black hole, that's another thing that we're hoping to that I think a lot of people will be working on, not just me, but others.
Well, Anil, you were just in Europe presenting on this. Who were you presenting to and what was their response?
I was at a conference in Italy, and it was a conference that was on the formation of supermassive black holes. So it kind of brought together people who are working on the theories for how supermassive black holes form with people who are observing with James Webb, the very first early supermassive black holes that we're finding with that telescope. And I presented this work there. The week before that, I was in Heidelberg working with the lead author on the paper is Max Haberle. He's the one who led all the work on this project.
And where is he from?
He's from the Max Planck Institute of Astronomy in Heidelberg, Germany.
Wow. So this was truly an international effort.
Yeah, lots of early morning meetings because of the time difference.
Well, that's fantastic.
People are pretty excited, I would say, about the result. I think a lot of people are, this is, as I mentioned, there's been a missing evidence for black holes in this mass range. And I think there's a lot of people have thought, and myself included, that maybe these black holes just don't exist. And so then that tells it, there's a lot of assumptions associated with that. If they don't exist, then that means that whatever formed the supermassive black holes must have been really big initially. And so there was a lot of discussion about that at the conference, whether this breaks different theories. I think that's the, people are still trying to figure it out.
Well, your next presentation is going to be on Thursday, August 8th at 7:00 at the Clark Planetarium. What can people expect to hear and see from you on Thursday?
Yeah, I mean, some of the same things I'm saying here, I guess.
Probably, but, so this is just a preview.
With lots of beautiful visuals. We have both movies and images, beautiful images, and hopefully really nice, well put together, cogent explanations of how we found this. So I'm really excited. We have actually I'm giving a talk at 7 and then that filled up almost right away. And now I'm giving one at 5 too. So right now there's only tickets available for the 5 p.m. one. So I'm really excited to have that so many people are gonna come out and hear about this.
In addition to discovering important essential data about black holes, you've also started the world's first dark sky studies minor at the University of Utah. That sounds really exciting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I didn't start it. I helped start with a large group of people. Yeah, so several years ago, I guess it's maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, we started working on trying to create this interdisciplinary, we call it transdisciplinary because it really is kind of synthesizing different disciplines, program to address light pollution and to think about the impacts of that and to think about how to ameliorate the impacts of that. And the program is actually housed in the City and Metropolitan Planning Department. You can imagine why, right? Like we need, in order to fix light pollution problems, we need designers and architects to take that into account. And I guess I'll just mention, that there's like a bunch of different reasons why this is important apart from astronomy. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this so interdisciplinary. Of course, when we, for instance, observe from our telescope in Chile, this beautiful star cluster, if we have a lot of light pollution, that'll ruin our observations. But also it affects our human health. So there's a lot of evidence that light pollution can impact our circadian rhythms. Everyone kind of remembers that their phones like turn different colors at night. All that stuff is related to the fact that light really impacts your biology. And there's evidence that light pollution can increase risks of cancer, as well as, of course, just making you sleep badly, which affects all of us. So there's human health impacts, and there's also a lot of wildlife impacts, birds, migrating birds, especially sea turtles, insects. So, I think there's a lot of reasons to care about this, but I think for me, the one that I'm most passionate about is just being able to appreciate a dark sky. And I think one of the wonderful things about living in Utah is that we can do that just by driving an hour or two away from our cities. It'd be great if that was only a half hour away from our cities or 15 minutes away from our cities. Yeah. And so I think, that's our hope is that by having students learn more about this. They go out and they work in the world doing whatever they're doing, and they help change.
Speaking of dark skies, Lynn, my co-host, and I were just recently at the Bryce Astronomy Festival, and you founded the internship program for astronomy outreach. Were you there this last year?
Yeah, I was. I was sitting at the big telescope on the end on Friday and Saturday nights, showing people a globular cluster on one night and a galaxy on another.
Oh yeah, so we probably, considering it was very dark, we probably talked to you that night.
You might have. I had a lot of 3-second conversations with people.
So what does that program, the internship program from Astronomy Outreach, what does that entail, and who participates in it?
Yeah, it's a nationwide program, so people from all across the country apply. This year we had a student from Michigan State and another one from Arizona who are our two interns. And they are just wrapping up, right? I think this week is their last week. And so we hired them, and then they worked down in the park basically as rangers for the summer, but focusing their activities on communicating about astronomy. So that includes doing ranger talks at the campground and setting up telescopes in the evenings, doing constellation tours, full moon walks, that kind of stuff. It's pretty cool job. I wouldn't mind doing it myself.
No, that sounds like a great job. So how did you get into specifically looking for black holes and astronomy? What is your background?
Yeah, I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And a lot of people who are into astronomy actually got into astronomy because they looked up at the night sky a lot. That actually isn't the reason I got into astronomy. I really liked the idea that you could learn about the universe just from observing it. And I find geology really appealing that way too, because it's kind of a similar science that way. And so that's what motivated me initially, I think, to kind of get involved, is I thought that was a really cool idea. And so, you know, I went to undergraduate school, graduate school, did a postdoc, and then became a faculty member here. So it's a very long pathway to become an astronomer. And I actually didn't initially work on black holes. I've worked on nearby galaxies. So the Andromeda galaxy, for instance, I've done a lot of work on, and other nearby galaxies where we can study galaxies in detail and their formation and histories. And then in my last year of my thesis, I found in the same galaxy sample that I was working on, these crazy nuclear star clusters that looked really weird, and I got excited about them. And that's what led me into working on black holes. Is I got interested in these nuclear star clusters. I thought they were really unusual. They're actually the densest stellar systems in the universe. And then got excited about, okay, like how are they related to the black holes that they live inside of them? And so then that's how I've gotten to work on black holes. And I would say the thing that I've been excited about with black holes is really this unknown question of how they formed. We don't know how these massive black holes that we find at the center of the galaxies form at all. And yet they play this really important role in galaxy formation, because when material falls onto the black hole, it can affect the entire galaxy that the black hole lives in, and regulate how many stars form in a galaxy. So they play this really important role in how we get from, you know, the Big Bang to a place like being a star in the Milky Way. These black holes actually play a role in that story. And I think that's really cool.
Oh, that's awesome. So what's next for you? Are you searching for more of these fast stars, or onto something else?
Yeah, I think we're definitely, I mean, so I think the James Webb Space Telescope data is really exciting. I'm looking forward to it. You know, I have a number of students working on different projects that are, one is actually an earlier James Webb Space Telescope project on nearby galaxy black holes that just a little bit of material is falling onto, and trying to characterize them and understand them. So that is the work I'm working on currently. That's like my active paper that I'm working on right now.
Well, you're going to be busy. And just a reminder to all of our listeners, you can hear Anil Seth's speech or talk about these black holes on Thursday, August 8th at the Clark Planetarium. Tickets are only available at 5:00. We will put a link in our show to those tickets. Well, our guest today has been Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Utah and the co-principal investigator of this extraordinary black hole discovery and finding, Anil Seth. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. You can stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app, or ask your smart speaker to play KPCW. Also, all of our shows are on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.